This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, sports fans report having stronger social connections than people who aren't into sports. We'll talk to the author of the new book, Fans Have More Friends. Now, the midterm elections have passed with Tony Evers and Ron Johnson both winning re-election. With a close U.S. Senate race and a slightly less close race for governor, small changes in voting patterns can make a big difference. Turnout in rural, suburban, and urban areas can change from election to election, so can the partisan gap in key counties. Our next guest has been breaking down the numbers and the trends, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Did the results line up to your expectations in this midterm? If you had any, what are some of the big changes you've noticed when it comes to voting outcomes in your part of the state, wherever you are? Have you seen changes, flips from one party to another, changes in turnout? What do you think is driving those? What do you think could happen to make a different party maybe be more competitive? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Craig Gilbert is a Lubar Center Fellow at Marquette University Law School's Lubar Center for Public Policy Research and Civic Education. He was the longtime Washington Bureau Chief from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, still writes for them from time to time. Craig, welcome back to Central Time.
It's great to be with you.
Before we start digging into the trends, a key point I mentioned, we have close elections here in Wisconsin. Even a subtle change in outcomes in a county or type of county or whatever can make a big difference, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're on a knife's edge, and it doesn't take much, as we've seen from all the crazy close presidential elections we've had in Wisconsin. It doesn't take much to change the outcome of an election.
All right. Now, there's in a recent piece on this you wrote, the headline, I guess, is trend continues when it comes to Wisconsin's most densely populated counties and least densely populated counties. What's happening?
So we've seen this starting in 2016, you know, with kind of the realignment of the party coalitions that Donald Trump kind of accelerated, we've seen a distinct trend, and it has to do with the growth of the urban-rural divide. It has to do with Democrats doing better in more populous places and Republicans doing better in less populous places. So I'm talking about the election shifts. So What we saw in this election was more of what we've been seeing, which is Republicans continuing to gain ground in rural counties, especially in the northern and western halves of the state. But that trend is flattening out a little bit. But the trend that's really proceeding pretty dramatically is the erosion of Republican margins in the suburbs. And so certainly the WOW counties, the Waukesha, Ozaukee, and Washington are not performing nearly as well for Republicans as they used to. And then in the close-in suburbs around Madison and Milwaukee, those are getting bluer and bluer all the time.
Yeah, let's talk about those WOW counties, because it used to be on election night, you'd watch turnout in Dade and Milwaukee County for Democrats, and you'd watch those suburban counties for Republicans. Each side would try to run up the score in each of those. Now, in those suburban counties, you're not saying, I think, that Democrats are like winning or even close to winning those counties, but they've cut the margin in really significant ways.
Yeah, so the most extreme example is probably Ozaukee County, where I think Tony Evers lost Ozaukee County for governor by around 11 points. Ozaukee County used to be the most reliably Republican county in the state. And now I think in this election, it was like 45th out of 72. So Ozaukee County has done a real shift. You know, it's the highest, I think, earning county or highest income level county in the state, highest education possibly. And so, parts of Ozaukee County, maybe one or two communities, are now actually even voting Democratic in some of these races. We're seeing the margins in Waukesha County and even Washington County, which is still very, very Republican. We're seeing the margins decrease. So in places that Republicans used to be winning by 45 points, they're now winning by 25 points. That is really significant in a tight statewide election.
Talking to Craig Gilbert from Marquette University Law School's Lubar Center, longtime Washington Bureau Chief from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at trends in elections here in Wisconsin. Who is voting for whom and in what numbers? And you could join in with a report if you'd like from your part of the state or a question for Craig at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Jeff is with us in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Good afternoon. I'm excited to tell you this because it's the first time it's happened in a generation. I know in my lifetime, we've always had a congressman, you know, Dave Obey was in office for, you know, 40
forever.
Years.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, and we had an assembly representative, Frank Boyle, was in office for, 40 years as well. But now we got three Republicans elected to the elected offices we have up here. We got District 25 State Senate. Republican Romaine Quinn, we got Angie Sapik as District 73 Assembly, and we got Tom Tiffany as our congressman. So all three offices are Republican now. The red wave did hit northern Wisconsin, and it's significant going back 60, 70 years.
Jeff, thanks a lot for that call. And Craig, people were really watching Jeff's neighborhood this year, in part for Republican hopes of getting a legislative supermajority in the state. They didn't. This is part of that trend, though, of less urban and less suburban communities going more Republican.
Yeah, I mean, those three counties in the extreme northwestern corner of Wisconsin are still, they still voted Democratic for governor, but the margins are getting smaller. And then within those counties, outside of the most Democratic cities, the towns, the countryside is getting a lot more Republican. And obviously that showed up and that shows up in these legislative races. So one of the things I was looking for in this election, again, was whether, how much more ground could Democrats lose in these small counties? And if you look at the 40 counties in Wisconsin that produce the fewest votes, which is kind of just a rough way of saying the 40 smallest counties, the Republicans improved their margin in 37 of the 40 in the governor's race from 4 years ago to this year. So they clearly are still gaining ground in smaller counties, but it doesn't add up to a huge number of votes gained because, you know, they're gaining modest ground and the big shifts already occurred, you know, 4 years ago and 6 years ago. And also there's fewer voters in these counties. At the opposite end of the spectrum, you know, the big counties continued swinging for Democrats, whether they're Republican counties or Democratic counties. And there, that has had a more profound impact on the bottom line in this election because the swing in these populous counties, you know, is a bigger vote swing. And that's why you saw Tony Evers win by a bigger margin this time than last time.
Yeah, let's look at Dane County for a minute. Wisconsin Conservative Digest, I'm on their mail list. They sent a thread along with a lot of Republican strategists and a lot of focus on Dane County, interestingly. Bill McCoshin, longtime key Republican strategist, quoting from his part of this. Dane County is the fastest growing county in Wisconsin, and the GOP continuously gets slaughtered there. The only way to fix that is to invest in the ground and air war over a sustained period in Dane County, rather than ignoring it and hoping to make up the difference someplace else. He goes on, we don't need to win Dane County to win statewide. We do need 30 to 35% instead of 22 or 23%. Republicans very conscious in this thread that they need to do something in Dane County, it seems like.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that sort of puzzled me in the last few years about this is that, you know, when Democrats got annihilated in rural counties in 2016, there was all this soul searching and hand wringing, but it meant that there was a lot of thought that went into and a lot of discussion that went into what happened. How could we do this better? It doesn't mean they found the answers, but it means there was certainly a recognition of the fact that this was a really damaging trend for the party. And it was important for the party to think about how to become more competitive and how to reduce their deficits in those places. I haven't heard the same thing until now on the Republican side about places like Dane County. You hear it about Milwaukee. There's a long history of Republicans trying to kind of cut into their deficits in Milwaukee, in the city of Milwaukee. But it's like Dane County, it's almost like it's conceded that Democrats are going to wipe them out in Dane County, and the margins keep getting bigger. And then when you layer on the population growth, the impact of these growing Democratic margins is profound on statewide elections. And so absolutely the logic is impeccable there of, you know, hey, if you can lose Dane County by 50 points instead of 55 points, that improves your odds of winning a statewide election.
Let's go back to our callers. Deanna is with us in Bayfield County. Deanna, hi.
Hi. Yeah. Can you hear me?
Loud and clear. What did you want to bring up, Deanna?
Oh, good. Yeah, I would like to hear your thoughts on the fact that gerrymandering is so severe in the state of Wisconsin. I just feel we can vote Democratic in the big elections, but because the Republicans have gerrymandered so severely, I believe we're the most gerrymandered state in the union now, that trying to get representatives back into the legislation is almost impossible.
Deanna, thanks a lot for that call. And Craig, those same trends we were talking about, you know, gerrymandering doesn't affect the governor and U.S. Senate race, but those trends we were talking about do have a big impact on the, as Deanna says, a gerrymandered legislative district.
Yeah, I mean, I've been studying this for a long time. And, you know, when the subject comes up about the legislative imbalance, Democrats, the answer you hear from Democrats is the gerrymander. And the answer you hear from Republicans is, well, Democrats just aren't competitive anymore in rural areas, and it's their own fault. And the truth is that both things are very significantly driving this. I mean, obviously, Democrats would be more competitive in the legislature if they did better or performed like they used to in rural counties and small towns. But the gerrymandering effect is profound, and it can't just be dismissed. And it's sort of like, you know, I think, you know, my rule of thumb is, you know, you got 99 seats in the assembly. If you had a neutral map, which basically just, you know, you draw districts that don't look funny, you sort of obey jurisdictional boundaries where you can, you make them as compact as you can, I think Republicans would have like a 13 or 10 to 15 seat natural advantage in the assembly because of their power in rural Wisconsin. But instead, they have an advantage that's twice that big. And the other profound impact of gerrymandering is the way to gerrymander a state is to basically get rid of competitive districts, because you want to pack all the other party's voters into as few districts as possible, and then you want to maximize the number of safe seats your own party has. And the effect of that is you don't have any competitive districts. So we have this crazy situation where Wisconsin is unbelievably competitive in statewide elections, and it's got almost zero competition in legislative elections. And that's just nuts. It raises issues of accountability. And it's just, I think, is really not a healthy situation, just from a partisan point of view, because I think it's just as bad when in those states where Democrats gerrymander. I think it's just really unhealthy from a Democratic and civic point of view.
Deanna, thanks for the call. We're talking to Craig Gilbert, Lubar Center Fellow at Marquette Law School, former Washington Bureau Chief at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, talking to us about big voting trends here in Wisconsin in the midterm elections. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you seen things changing in your part of the state? Is there something you'd like to hear from one or both of the parties to appeal to your community? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Craig Gilbert, Lubar Center Fellow at Marquette University Law School, longtime observer of Wisconsin politics, looking at Wisconsin voting trends and what happened in the midterm elections. Still time for your calls at 800-642-1234. Why do you think Republicans are doing better and better over time in rural parts of the state? Democrats doing better and better in Milwaukee County, Dane County, some shifts in the suburbs as well. Join in at 800-642-1234. Craig, want to check in on a couple other parts of the state. First of all, Milwaukee County, big advantage for Democrats. What did we see there in terms of margin and turnout this year?
So we saw a bigger margin than ever. I believe Democrats won Milwaukee County by more than 40 points. And Milwaukee County generated a bigger raw vote margin for Evers by about 10,000 votes than it did 4 years earlier. But the turnout declined. I mean, it was easily the biggest turnout decline in the state, certainly in raw votes. And also, I think, you know, one of the biggest, I think it was the biggest decline in turnout proportionately. So those two things didn't quite cancel each other out, but Democrats actually just, again, performed better in Milwaukee County, bigger margins, more votes, more vote margins, but smaller turnout. So, you know, that's something for Democrats to keep an eye on. And particularly in the city of Milwaukee, the turnout, the number of ballots cast went down by an even larger amount. Again, the margins are still huge, but in really close elections, this can come into play. I think it certainly hurt Mandela Barnes that there wasn't a bigger turnout in the city of Milwaukee. I don't think mathematically you can argue that it flat out cost him the election, but you know, you can imagine an even closer election where it could have cost him the election.
And before we go back to our callers, Northeastern Wisconsin, Fox Cities, Green Bay, what trends did we see there?
That's obviously, you know, when you look at all the big counties, you've got the big Republican counties like Waukesha, you've got the big Democratic counties like Milwaukee and Dane, but these are big purple counties relative to the rest of the state. So Brown County, which is Green Bay, Outagamie County, which includes Appleton and Winnebago County, the Bow counties, if you want to call them that.
I do know.
They moved in a Democratic direction in the governor's race compared to 4 years ago. So they tend to be, you don't see the same like relentless trend in these counties like you see in Waukesha or Dane, where the same thing keeps happening. They kind of swing back and forth a little bit more. So we've seen elections where Republicans have been, you know, prospering there or more. I mean, the margins are single digit, but Democrats did pretty well, at least in the governor's race in the Fox Valley this time around. Again, it sort of fits into this pattern of the bigger counties seeing a shift in a Democratic direction.
Let's go back to our callers. Jack is on the line in Madison. Jack, hello.
Hi there. So it's really interesting because we saw that, well, obviously Tony Evers took back the governor's or held on to it, which we're grateful for. But I saw that in neighboring Michigan and Minnesota, obviously they were able to hold on to the governor's seats as well. But then somehow they were able to complete the blue trifecta. So Dems were able to reclaim the legislatures in both Michigan and Minnesota. And even though it seems like we have quite a bit of work ahead of us to do the same in Wisconsin, what will it take for us to complete our own blue trifecta and join our neighbors in that regard?
Thanks for the call, Jack. So Jack would like to see Wisconsin do what happened in Michigan and Minnesota with, as he said, complete Democratic control in both of those states. But this kid, Wisconsin, is doing its own thing. What is different about Wisconsin versus its upper Midwest neighbors?
Well, we talked about gerrymandering, and that does come into play here. I know that Michigan had a referendum that reformed the redistricting process, and that created maps, you know, more equitable maps that, you know, made it possible in a good Democratic year, at least in Michigan, for them to control the legislature. There's literally no way possible for Democrats to win the legislature with these maps. I think the other, in Wisconsin I'm talking, and then I think the other difference is, you know, with respect to Minnesota and Michigan, you have a bigger concentration of the electorate or bigger proportion of the electorate that's in this sort of metropolitan counties. And so in Wisconsin, there's proportionally a bigger kind of non-metropolitan vote. So the Democratic problem in the rural counties is a bigger problem in Wisconsin for Democrats than it is in these two other states.
Thanks for the call. We'll go to Lynn now in Wauwatosa. Lynn, hi.
Oh, hi. I wonder if you can comment on the obscene amount of campaign contributions that are given, particularly by a few billionaires, which in my mind means that they basically bought the Senate. I think we'll see Mandela Barnes again because he's such a talented and good candidate. But I'm disgusted by the obscene amount of money that has, I think, contaminated the election system.
Lynn, I gotcha. Thanks for the call. And Craig, I think a lot of people saw ads for incumbents Tony Evers and Ron Johnson and some ads for their challengers, but a lot of money got dumped here.
Yeah, I mean, you can, you know, what happened in this election? Well, the two incumbents in the big statewide races both won, and both of them, you know, there wasn't a lot of separation in those two races. There was about a 4-point difference in the margin, you know, a 3-point Democratic victory and for governor, a 1-point Republican victory for U.S. Senate. How do you explain that? Well, one of the factors, I mean, is certainly incumbency is an advantage, but one reason incumbency is an advantage is you tend to have more resources than your opponent. And so it was the case that Democrats had a financial advantage in the governor's race. I'm pretty sure about that. And Republicans had a financial advantage in the U.S. Senate race, in particular in the weeks after the primary, August primary, where, you know, there's evidence in the polling that this that phase of the campaign was really damaging to Mandela Barnes because he was outspent. He was getting, you know, hit on television with a lot of negative ads. And that seemed to, if you believe the polls, that seemed to, you know, affect that race. So, yeah, I mean, this is a feature of our system now. I mean, obviously, money has always played a role. But you do have, you know, really wealthy people, you know, certainly on the Republican side in this race, in these state races, it has happened in races on the Democratic side as well, that just have the ability to kind of bankroll a race almost limitlessly. They can't do it by giving directly to a candidate, but they can do it just by funding, you know, quote, you know, third party advertising and or independent expenditures and affect a race that way. This is now a feature of our system, and it's, you know, it's impactful.
Our last half a minute, Craig, every year or every election, I think, okay, things can't get worse for Republicans in Dane County. Things can't get worse for Democrats in rural Wisconsin. I've been wrong every time lately. Is there a bottom?
Well, I think there may be a bottom. We may see the bottom sooner on the rural side, just because the shifts were so dramatic in 2016 that, you know, it may be that we're approaching the point where Democrats can't sink too much further. The shifts in the suburbs have been, you know, ongoing, and they don't seem to have abated in this election. So that would be the troubling thing on the Republican side, would be, you know, what is the bottom? I mean, because there's still some of these communities, a lot of them are still Republican, but they're getting less Republican. So I don't know, you know, they're going to have to do some soul searching to figure out how to sort of stop the bleeding. They thought they would stop the bleeding in this cycle for a variety of reasons, but it didn't happen.
Craig, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Absolutely.
That's Craig Gilbert, longtime political observer, looking at some of the big voting trends from the midterm elections here in Wisconsin. Tomorrow on the morning show, the open enrollment period for the Affordable Care Act. Find out what you need to know tomorrow on the Ideas Network. If you are listening in Wisconsin, you probably saw some snow today. You might be seeing it right now. I looked around the Weather Service page. Seems like everybody's getting a little something. To honor the occasion and the transition toward winter-style weather, we're having a conversation tomorrow about our favorite winter activities, indoor and outdoor. And you can share yours right now. Email ideas@wpr.org. What does snowy weather make you want to do? Embrace it. Get ready for some skiing, snowshoeing, ice fishing, winter hiking, other outdoor activities. Or is it the signal to look over your supply of board games, jigsaw puzzles, movies, and TV shows to catch up on, the stack of books and other indoor stuff? Or do you have some from each category? Let us know right now. Email ideas@wpr.org. We could share your responses tomorrow on the show. Winter is coming, and we can have some fun with it. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Being a fan of a sports team can be a source of joy when they win and disappointment when they lose. But it turns out, despite the ups and downs, having strong sports allegiances and connections may actually be good for you overall. In a series of interviews, surveys, and other research, our next guest found that people who are invested in sports teams tend to be happier, more open-minded, and have deeper, more rich social relationships in their lives. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What does being a sports fan mean to you? Do you have a community of people that you watch the big game, whatever the game might be, with friends, family, coworkers, whoever happens to show up at the bar that day? Let us know. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. David Sikoriak is founder of Dexterity Consulting, a former executive at Madison Square Garden. He's co-author of the new book, brand new book, Fans Have More Friends. Dave, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
You and your co-author, Dave, have been in the sports world a long time. What led you down this path of looking at the social and community benefits of being a fan?
Yeah, when we started working in sports, we began seeing this pattern of social relationships incentivizing the behavior. So, you know, I was working at the Knicks, and why would somebody be a Knicks season ticket holder, especially when the team is not performing well? Well, when you spend time with people and, you know, do ethnographic research, what you begin to see is there's a web of social relationships around. And so we were doing this, and we began seeing this. You know, we were studying baseball fans, we were studying NFL fans. World Cup came around in 2018. We explored that. And this pattern manifested over and over again, that the bigger fans had a lot of social relationships. So we're like, how can we test this proposition in a way to prove it out that this exists on scale? And we were, you know, not convinced that it would manifest on scale, but we devised an approach to test how big of a fan one is and to test how robust one's social network is. And long story short, what we found was the bigger fan you are, the more friends you have. And it's not only that, the bigger fan you are, the more you interact with those friends, the more you value those relationships. And then when we focused it on family, the bigger fan you are, the more you interact with your mom, your dad, your kids, your spouse, and the more you value those relationships. So on and on, we began seeing these, no matter how you looked at the measurement of your social network, you saw that bigger fans were really tapping into this. And this is the beauty of sports. It just gives you constant opportunities to engage with others, to have random conversations with a stranger, or have a heart-to-heart with your dad talking about the Packers beating the Cowboys on Sunday.
Now, what is it about sports in particular and not something else, our hobbies or whatever it might be?
You know, we are pro-social interaction. So if it's, you know, if you're connecting over yoga or woodworking, good for you. That's great, and you should do that, and because it's going to be healthy for you. The beauty of sports is it exists at a scale like no other.
Right.
Right. It's like, you know, we could talk about The Sopranos. So, you know, that's my reference point for a show that captivated us, or one of the early shows back in the early 2000s. It doesn't compare to, you know, somebody having a conversation about The Sopranos versus having a conversation about this Sunday's game between Packers and Cowboys. It doesn't compare, because sports exists at a scale that is unlike anything else. So you're likely to go into a bar and bump into a football fan. You're not likely to bump into a Sopranos fan or a Game of Thrones fan or somebody who practices yoga or likes to hike. They're possible. It's just you can't bank that one in.
Well, to that point, we heard from Joel on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Joel says, living in Green Bay, one is surrounded by Packers fans. Sports is a huge part of our local identity. The Packers bring much income to our community and do a lot of charitable work here and across the whole state. And Joel says, we greet each other on Mondays after a win with "How about those Packers?" instead of "Hi, how are you?" Now, Green Bay is special, but it doesn't have to be Green Bay, right, Dave?
You know, it doesn't have to be. And Green Bay is special there, but it is, you know, what it is just like a point of common connection that a community has, that they can signal something and it could start a random conversation. So, you know, talking about the Packers game is an easy way in. I see somebody with a Cowboys hat, I could say, tough loss on Sunday. And they're like, yeah, thank you. You know, again. But, you know, those interactions are really healthy for us, right? And the pandemic taught us that. We miss those interactions with the people on the periphery of our social networks, the barista, you know, somebody you see when you're heading into work, all those kind of, you know, distant interactions that you can have, the one-off hello, are really healthy for us. And sports is a way that we can actually make those distant interactions much more fruitful.
Talking to Dave Sikoriak, co-author of the new book, Fans Have More Friends, about the social community benefits of being part of a fan community. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this something you see in your own community, in your own life, in your family? Do you bond with people maybe in small ways, maybe in bigger ways, over your team or your sport, whatever it may be? Call in and tell us about it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Dave, you see this as a solution to a couple problems. We hear again and again about an epidemic of loneliness in the U.S., of a lack of connection. COVID obviously didn't help that. You really see this connection we have over sports as being at least part of the cure.
I think that's well positioned there. It's part of the cure. It is what sports fandom does for you is create a sense of belonging. And loneliness is the opposite state of belonging. And again, it gives you belonging in a way that is not just with those close to you, but could be those in the community and could be complete strangers, that it gives you one kind of central place of identity that you can connect with other people.
And to that point, you share, you know, you're working with survey data, but you also did focus groups and one-on-one interviews with people. One of my favorite stories was someone named Jennifer, originally family from Kingston, Jamaica, came with her family to the U.S., was in middle school, I think in California, not fitting in, and saw some kids in jerseys, football jerseys. She had been a football fan. Quoting here now, "I was like, you like football? They were like, dude, we love football. Who's your team? This one kid, Raymond, was like, the Raiders. And I was like, you're my people. I hang out with you now." And that really speaks to the ability of a lonely kid in that case to find their people.
Well, it is. I mean, you have me smiling because Jennifer is just a wonderful human and a great storyteller, and really comes alive in the book there. And it's such a basic way of looking at it. And, you know, fast forward to Jennifer, a grown adult, this powerful woman, multiple degrees, excelling in life. And she still looks back. It's like, yeah, you know, my relationship with my uncles when I came to this country were the seminal moments. They took me under their wing. They taught me Raiders football. They taught me how to throw a spiral. And that gave me the confidence to survive in, you know, as an immigrant, as a person of color, as a woman, on and on and on. These were kind of there were markers that she learned through just being able to interact on neutral ground with other people.
Okay, now another problem that we talk a lot about in the show, I was actually surprised to see it come up in your book, political polarization, where people kind of build an identity. I'm on this side, you're on that side, and so much of our identity then connects to that. Sports can be a way to cross cut. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, it's the biggest point of our book, and you know what we are most hopeful about of using sports fandom to help cure some of the ills of polarization. So we are polarized as a country, not that we have different political beliefs. That's actually could be productive. The problem is we have two separate universes of people that live different lives, that shop at different places, watch different TV shows, and rarely interact, watch different news outlets, and rarely interact with each other. And that what that does for us is it actually ratchets up the negative feeling, the hate towards other people. And what we saw various ways of looking at this is the bigger fan you are as a Republican, the less hate you have towards Democrats. So there's something used in political science called a feeling thermometer on a scale of 0 to 100, 0 being really cold, 100 being hot. So you ask Republicans how they feel about Democrats, they rate about a 20. You ask Democrats how they feel about Republicans, they average about a 22. But when you split each of those polls apart by how big of a fan they are, that moves from a 18 for non-fan Republicans to 27, or you know, we're in that range, and the same movement for Democrats. And really what's going on here is, to your point, are crisscross cutting identities. That we are living in separate bubbles. The one time those bubbles could actually intersect is around an NFL game, around a baseball game, around the World Cup that's coming up. These are moments that we are actually not Republicans, Democrats, we're Packers fans. Or I'm a Packers fan, you're a Cowboys fan, and we're gonna be at each other, but in a very playful way. That never happens with our politics today. You cannot talk about that, but you can debate, if you're a Cowboys fan, what they should have done in Sunday's game. And you could debate that from being white or black or Republican or Democrat or Christian or Jewish or whatever it is. And those debates are perfectly, everything's in bounds.
We're talking to brand consultant Dave Sikoriak about a new book that he co-wrote. It's called Fans Have More Friends, looking at the social benefits of being a sports fan, part of a sports community. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do sports mean in your life? Your group of friends, to your family? Do a lot of your social relationships involve sports? Does it matter whether your team is good or not this current year, this current decade, if you're a Detroit Lions fan? Sorry, century. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Dave Sikoriak, brand consultant and former sports business executive who co-wrote the new book called Fans Have More Friends. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Has being a fan of sports been a door opener for you in your social life and your connections with other people, whether that's just a quick chat at the store or, you know, building whole rituals about getting together for the game? Tell us about it. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Kevin is with us now in Janesville. Kevin, hi.
Hey, good afternoon. When I was a teenager, I discovered Australian rules football and tried to follow it for a while because ESPN was new and they had to fill their airtime with something. Years later, I met a man from Australia, which gave me an opening to strike up a friendship with somebody from half a world away.
Interesting. And Kevin, are you still following Australian rules football? Is it possible to do it now?
It's still possible. I tried to do it online. I've been watching at least the highlights and trying to keep track of who's who, but it's kind of hard.
Kevin, thanks a lot. But Dave, that speaks to, you know, this could be a way to reach out to people from different places and different cultures if we get into their sport. Might be obscure here. It's a big deal there.
Absolutely. And that's something Kevin had, like, sitting in his, he had built up this social equity, mm-hmm. was looking to spend it. He meets somebody from Australia and it paid off. And it was there. And that, you know, that's an extreme example there. But that exists, is paying attention to sports. You don't know when those opportunities come up, and the beauty of sports is someone can signal that to you, that they are, you know, they're from Dallas, they're from Green Bay, and it opens up conversation.
Kevin, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Dave, I want to talk about, you know, being a fan of a bad team. I joked about the Detroit Lions a few minutes ago. I grew up in southeastern Michigan. I was used to sports-related suffering. You wrote about Cubs fans who had a long, long World Series drought finally end. I've been watching this show, Welcome to Wrexham, about a team at the bottom of the English football, the soccer system there. Is there something special about being that long-enduring fan of a bad team?
Yeah, we often get the question of, like, some of this stuff is, you know, the bigger fan you are, the more friends you have, but it also, you know, works into well-being, that you're the happier you are, the more confident you are, the more optimistic you are. Any kind of measure of well-being, we see a positive relationship with sports fan. I mean, we could credit that to the social relationship, not necessarily sports. So we get the question of, like, well, what about those Lions fans? you know, so consistently bottom dwellers. And it works the same way. We don't see any difference from a data perspective. We don't see any difference in any kind of the friendship or happiness measures. But and when you think about sports fandom, the beauty of it is it provides you a range of emotions to connect over, right? So the Lions fans do a lot of commiserating and a lot of complaining and a lot of venting. But venting is good for you. There's, you know, many aspects of life that we hold things in. With sports, you don't hold it in. Somebody asks you, what do you think of the Lions, and you're a Lions fan, you'll share. You'll vent. And that has a positive benefit. Somebody's listening to you and you're able to let loose of something there. So sports, regardless, win or lose, provides you an opportunity to connect. And the reality is most teams lose at the end of the season.
Right.
There's one winner. So we all get to experience a loss and the jubilation. I'm a Yankees fan. And, you know, so we've had a lot of winning, but we Yankee fans are complaining now. We're itching. It's been 2009 since our last one. And so over the last 12 years, 13 years, there's been a lot more frustration at the end of the year for just in terms of connecting with other people. The frustration is just as valid as interaction that you can have as much as jubilation.
Now, I mentioned,
we vote for jubilation. We choose it every single time, but that's just not the reality.
Now, I mentioned the Chicago Cubs there, and you talked, I think it was a father and son who had kind of grown up around the Cubs in particular, and the memories they had, it wasn't, you know, remember winning this game or that game, I mean, there's some of that, but remember watching it with the family, that kind of thing. Could you talk about how families use sports?
Yeah, so this is, Lindsay and Nick, and so Nick lives in Chicago, dad lives in Central Illinois, so I met Nick in a focus group and then subsequently did an ethnography with him, and what I asked him was, like, you know, would you invite your dad up? I would like to meet your dad and hang out with the two of you. So we go to a Cubs game, and It's just beautiful, right? You just talk about life. Where I talked about my kids, where I'm from. I'm from New York. I'm a Yankees fan. They talked about their family and their interactions and being a Cubs fan. And there was a moment that we talk about in the book of, you know, I asked his dad of being able to go in 2016 to a World Series game. And, you know, I was like, how was that? How was that feeling? And he just chokes up. And doesn't, you know, he just like, he musters, it was special. And you know, what dawned on us, you know, in that interaction was, it wasn't the World Series game. It was the 35 years or so, or however old Nick was at the time, of relationship between father, son, father and sister, the family unit that they had, that so much of their life was made up of the Cubs. Like Nick would say, when I first met him, he said, the Cubs are, baseball is my family sport. That's what my family connects over. And they become signal for the years of a relationship. I mean, we have a quote in the book of, you know, when he, you know, sees Juan Santo clicking his heels, he thinks of being at home as a kid sitting on his dad's lap. These are really rich memories that sports, as much as anything else, really elicits in us.
We are talking about social connections we can make as sports fans and the benefits we get from them. Dave Sikoriak is with us, co-author of the new book, Fans Have More Friends. Still time for your story at 800-642-1234. A caller who couldn't stay on the line says, questions whether the friends you make, say, at the bar watching a game are really friends. Like, is there some value even to that casual connection you have? You and I happen to be sitting at the table next to each other, reacting to the game together?
Yes, 100%. We need all those types of interactions, right? So you need those close, intimate friends that you can share, you know, the details of your life, your struggles, and those are really important. But it's also important to, hey, did you see that play? What's going on? Where are you guys from? Oh, you went to school here. Do you know that? And that might be it. And but you, both of you, had an interaction with a complete stranger, predicated, you know, brought on by sports that are actually quite positive. So yeah, you might not everyone's going to be a lifelong friend, but every interaction can have a positive benefit.
I'm going to ask you for advice for people out there who might think, yeah, I like sports, okay, but I don't do this stuff. I don't get these connections. I don't talk to people about it. How can they leverage some of the work you guys have done to use sports to be more connected?
Well, think of someone in your network who's a sports fan, and invariably there's going to be people. You have somebody who's a Packers fan, pay attention loosely to the game. I mean, they came back. It was a big comeback. How'd you feel? The beauty of sports fans, if you ask them a question about their team and have their opinion, they will talk. They will give you enough material and they'll actually feel good. It's like, oh, you know that, you know, Tyler's a real listener. He's great and asks great questions. So I think the start is just pay attention a little bit more. Understand. And if you have somebody in your life that is a fan, ask them about these things. You know, you get invited to, you know, go watch a game here. You know, we're hosting a party. Come over. Instead of the, oh, I'm not really a football fan or whatever, just go over. It's not about the football. It's about going there and hanging out and connecting with other people. That's really it. So see those opportunities as not a way to dive into the details of sports, which you might not be as interested in or might not know as much about. See it as an opportunity to connect with others. Me, a Yankee fan, if I met you, you ask me any question about the Yankees, I'm happy to explain. I'll go on and on. I can teach a college level course on the Yankees for you. And I'm sure there's a lot of Packer fans that feel the same way. A lot of Bucks fans that feel the same way about it. Cause we're proud of this. This is, you know, having a sports team is really built into your identity. And it's something that we, you know, we put at the forefront of who we are. So you're a non-fan, you meet somebody who's a fan of another team, ask them about it. Cause they're really telling you about themselves.
And people might think, okay, yeah, if I went to a cricket watching party, I have no idea what's going on. I don't want to like be the dumb guy in the room who doesn't get the rules of cricket. How can we overcome that shyness?
Yeah, as a fan, I've evolved through doing this research. People like Jennifer, you mentioned, really taught me a different perspective. You know, I didn't have the same experience as a Jamaican immigrant coming in here, or I'm not a Jamaican immigrant, so I didn't have that same experience. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we sometimes build up so much into knowing about or sounding stupid. And I tell you, as a lifelong fan, I'm 50 years old now, it doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter. Even an innocent question is actually an opportunity that most sports fan would actually, you know, explain to you and not mock you as a result. They'd mock you if you're a Cowboys fan and have fun with you in that. But if you're coming in there and genuinely curious about something, I think most sports fans, you know, would actually indulge you on that.
Dave, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's David Sikoriak, founder of Dexterity Consulting, former executive at Madison Square Garden, with us today sharing the new book he's co-author of. It's called Fans Have More Friends. If you have a story to share, there's still time. You could do it over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Do you have a group of people you watch the game with, whether you're in person or across the country, maybe texting back and forth or talking about it afterward? How do sports fit into your social life and connectedness? Let us know on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, snow has fallen in a lot of Wisconsin now. We want to hear your favorite winter weather activities, whether they take you outside or you like to hunker down inside. Tell us about it. Email ideas@wpr.org. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.